lucky few podcast listeners and friends. We had so many incredible conversations in 2023. And before we kick off a new season in 2024, we're going to be throwing it back to some of our very favorite episodes from last year as we get excited to hit a milestone. Y'all, this is the year that we will hit our 1 millionth download. We're so close. We're just a few thousand away. Listeners, we are looking forward to another amazing season of shouting worth and shifting narratives for people with Down syndrome. From all of us here at the Lucky Few podcast, thank you for your support and enjoy this throwback episode. All right, friends, I just wrapped up a wonderful interview with three incredible people, and I'm not even going to tell you anything about it. You're just going to have to, this is the hook, and we're going to get straight into it because it was a long conversation worth every second. It is time to shout some worth and shift some narratives for people with Down syndrome. Welcome, everybody, to the Lucky Few podcast today. Three special guests, and we're chatting about a very important topic. I have attorney Anna Krager, self-advocate Craig Kinney, and his mom Sandy, who are here, and we get to discuss guardianship and self-determination for individuals with Down syndrome. We're so excited to hear from them. So let's get to it, friends. Welcome to the Lucky Few podcast. Before we hear from our guests, I'm going to read a review from one of you amazing listeners. This review is from Kaylee C., who says, I love the variety of topics discussed. They touch on so many things that I wonder about as a mom of a son with Down syndrome. You also feel a part of a larger community, which helps me not feel so alone in my journey. Kaylee C., we're so grateful that you're a part of the community. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Listeners, if you have not left a review and you like this podcast as well, we would love to hear from you. You can head over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, leave that review, and we may read it here next week. The feedback means so much to us, and it's great for people who are looking for podcasts to know what they're getting into. So thank you for the review. Speaking of a variety of topics discussed, Kaylee, I just wrapped up a conversation that was so, so meaningful. I'm going to tell you about our guest, and you're going to get to listen to this conversation. And we're talking about supported decision-making as an alternative to guardianship and conservatorship, okay? I just had the conversation, and so it's fresh on my mind, but I think that there's a chance that I alluded to the letting, how do I say this? I think I'm thinking back on this conversation, and there was a moment that Josh, our editor, is most likely going to keep in. And it may have sounded as though I was saying choosing guardianship or conservatorship and linked it somehow to ableism, and I don't believe that to be true. So I just need to give that out there. I know that we have listeners who are listening to this episode who have chosen guardianship or conservatorship for their child with Down syndrome. And there is no, I don't want you to like feel judged in any decision you made. I just feel like I need to say at the beginning of this conversation, because that's not at all what this conversation was about. But we are discussing an alternative to guardianship and conservatorship by people who feel that the alternative is the better choice. So as I was thinking back on the conversation, I thought, I don't want anyone to feel judged or othered for a decision that they've made. I hope that this is an eye-opening decision for people. Maybe you've heard of this before. I had not, about supported decision-making. Slow down, Heather. So I wanted to say that up front, caveat, before we get into this conversation, but let me introduce you to our guests. So here with me today, I have Anna Krager, Sandra, and Craig Kinney. Anna Krager is the executive director of Massachusetts Advocates for Children, a legal advocacy organization that works to remove barriers to education for children and youth who are discriminated against because of disability, race, immigration status, or language. Hashtag she's a bad mama jamma. Do we say that instead of cussing? Anna is a nationally recognized expert on supported decision making and has trained, advocated, and written widely on the topic alongside decision makers and their supporters. She has spent her legal career working at a range of disability justice organizations advocating for choice and inclusion for disabled people. She's a graduate of Berkeley Law and Harvard College. Sandra is a Massachusetts developmental disability council member. She and her son, Craig, have a powerful story of their experience using guardianship alternatives so that Craig can make his own choices with support and avoid guardianship. Craig works, lives on his own, and loves to travel and eat at restaurants. Sandra has fought alongside Craig for him to have every opportunity to make his own decisions and live a life in the community. We are so grateful to have them on the show today. Here we go. Okay, so I'm so excited, Anna and Sandra and Craig, to have you on the show today. Thank you for coming to the Lucky Few podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us. And Craig did a peace sign back there, I think. Was that what
we did? Yes.
Perfect. Will you introduce yourself a little bit? I know I already gave an intro of who you are, but just so our listeners can hear your voices and know who's talking. Anna, we'll start with
Great.
You.
So nice to talk to everyone today. My name's Anna Krieger. I'm the executive director of Massachusetts Advocates for Children, and I've been an advocate working on supported decision making for quite a while now. Mass Advocates for Children focuses on educational advocacy for kids with disabilities and working on discrimination, racial discrimination, and racial equity. And supported decision making is so much a part of the life journey of so many people with disabilities, including youth. So I'm really happy to be part of the conversation today. And I should add, I'm a lawyer, I guess. That's important, too.
Yeah. Yeah. How about you, Sandy and Craig?
Sure. I'll go. My name is Sandy Heller, and I am actually the mom of this wonderful guy, Craig Kinney, who's sitting next to me. He's a man of few words, I always say. He's much more expressive when you see him on film than he is when it comes to just verbally talking. But when he does talk, we listen, and it's about him and his life. He's my firstborn child. I have three children. We live in Massachusetts. He lives in Fairhaven. I live in Marion, close to the Cape area. And Craig is going to be 36 at the end of the month. And he has been a man that's practiced supported decision making since he was 18 years old. So he's got this very well down and very good at being able to express to people around him and the people that care about him what his wants and needs are and be respected for making his own choices in this world that we live in. So, Rosane, say hello.
Hello.
Hi, Craig. Thanks for being here. I love it. Thank you guys. So I had heard of your work in Massachusetts. Massachusetts, can we just give a shout out? There's so much good stuff going on there when it comes to disability. I mean, how do we get that here? That's another podcast, but so much good stuff going on in Massachusetts, just leaders in that state. But I've heard about the advocating for reform of guardianship and conservatorship systems with the focus on promoting that method that you said, supported decision-making as an alternative. I want to talk about supportive decision-making, what that means when you say that, and also what we're talking about when we're talking about guardianship and conservatorship. So which order do you think is best to take those questions?
I say let's start with guardianship and conservatorship, okay, since that's what people kind of know about, and then go to the alternative.
Yeah. And I'll say too, and I said this to you guys, listeners, I told them before we recorded that this feels like a self-serving conversation for me, because it is something that is there in my mind, right? Like this is something in my future. I have two kids with Down syndrome. And I think a lot of us who are parents, disability or not, and even more so with disability, you're inundated with daily tasks that it's hard to think to the future. With my daughter, my oldest daughter, Macy, we just had her transition IEP for high school, which is mind-blowing. There's no way she's older than 5, and I don't know what's happening here. So there's like the emotional piece, but the reality of, okay, looking into the future, it's always important as a parent and always so hard to do or hard to make time for or hard to prioritize. And then getting to a point where it's like, well, shoot, have I waited too long? There's all these different questions, and conservatorship and guardianship are one of those things that I personally, I've never even... I hear about it, but when it comes to my personal journey, it's not even a conversation that I've had until this very moment. So yeah, what is guardianship and conservatorship?
I can take that one. And then Sandy, why don't you and Craig explain the alternative? A guardianship or a conservatorship is the name for what happens when a court appoints a third party to make decisions on behalf of another person. And it happens when the court has made some kind of finding that that person is unable to make their own decisions and so needs that third party to make those decisions for them. And it gets tricky right away because every state has their own process, their own terms. You're in California, that's where guardianships are called conservatorships. In most of the country, they're called guardianship. So it gets really, really complicated really fast. But at the end of the day, what it really means is that the person with the disability or the older adult has some designated person who is going to be making those decisions for them. And the court is deciding what types of decisions. It might not be all of the kind of universe of decisions that could be made, but it might be all of them. And there's different terms that get thrown around. People might hear plenary guardianship or limited guardianship. And that's describing that difference where a plenary guardianship is, a guardianship over all of the issues and a limited guardianship is over just some of them.
Okay. And the guardianship conservatorship, which is interesting that California is one of the few states that calls it a conservatorship, exists as it is. And then you have been working towards a method called supported decision making as an alternative to a guardianship and conservatorship, correct?
That's right. Yeah. And I should have added, a lot of people have heard the word guardianship maybe related to minors, but what we're talking about is guardianship of adults. So this is all happening after someone reaches the age of 18.
Okay. Which has always been my understanding for conservatorship. It's always been an adult attached to that in my limited understanding, but that's a good clarification to make too for guardianship. So then what is supported decision making?
So I can go. And Craig, do you want me to talk about your supported decision making?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So Craig will a lot of times have his mom talk for him because one of the things, again, around supported decision making is making the availability for a person to make their own decisions, not going to court at the age of 18. And that is something that Craig and his family made a decision a very long time ago, as he's turning 36, to not pursue guardianship when he turned 18. And typically, there are many families that have children with Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, other developmental disabilities, that they are encouraged to go the approach of guardianship at the age of 18, that people are not competent to make their own decisions. And that's a personal and family journey to discuss. For our family and for Craig, we never once thought about going into court to obtain guardianship and appoint somebody to make his decisions. Craig has had a journey, like everyone has had a journey, and his journey started when he was born. He was born in 1987, and at that time, many of the smaller children with Down syndrome were going to a educational collaborative away from the regular school, and I think our journey was like, well, why would we do that? Why can't he just go to the regular preschool? And so that's how our journey began. And we've always been that kind of a family where, well, why not? And so Craig was able to go to regular school with his sisters. The specialist came to him. He had a journey through junior high and high school where he became very medically involved. He ended up with a tracheostomy and had no airway to his vocal cords. And he needed a one-to-one nurse. And again, it was like, well, why wouldn't he just go to junior high and high school and bring the nurse with him? And so that's been our journey. And so for Craig, supported decision making was a very easy decision for us to make. You know, he and as many people with a disability, Craig has a verbal apraxia that goes along with his Down syndrome. Beyond having the medical needs growing up, it's been difficult for him to verbally communicate, but that doesn't mean he doesn't understand. And we see that every day. You know, every day he's able to make his own decision of where he wants to live, who he wants to be with. What I always do is I talk about where who he wants to vote for. And we have very different opinions on that. but that's...
Do I dare ask? I'm just kidding. I'm not going to ask.
Look at him. Right? I'll tell you, the thing about that, Heather, is that I do not bring him to vote. It's been a number of years since I will bring him to the poll to vote because we have differences of our political views. And so I've told him flat out, find somebody else to take you. And guess what he does?
Perfect.
So we have been practicing support decision making even before there was a move with the name of support decision making. When Craig was 18, it was just, we just went along with our journey of what his life was, offered him people in his life that care about him. Some are his family, some are paid staff members to help him when it comes to making everyday decisions to larger, bigger decisions, just like you or I would. You know, I've never made a decision just solely on my own. I've always had to include whether it was a husband or my grown children or my mother or father who are still thankfully alive. We still do that on a natural basis as human beings, getting people that we care about some information to be able to make the best decision possible. And that's what Craig does. And he's also entitled to make mistakes like everyone else is too. And I think that's a great learning possibility too. I always say that to families, you know, and some families look at me strangely, like, why do you want them to make mistakes? I think it's a way that we all learn. I'm not going to let them run in front of a bus, but I do want him to learn, you know, if you make this decision, these are the good things that can happen. These are the things that may not be so good. And again, like with anyone, and my daughters as well, they have to be supported to make those decisions that mean the most to them. If you know people, I know with Craig, I always say, you know, I joke about it. Maybe it's part of the extra chromosome, but boy, can they be stubborn. And when he's that way, I think it's great. It just shows how his conviction of what he wants to do is so important. Now we have to hear it. Mm-hmm. We have to honor it and we have to go for it.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I have so much I want to follow up with there. And I just have more questions. I have so many more questions. So I real quick have to say as an aside, you said about when he started preschool, you said they were going to send him to an educational collaborative. That was just a really gracious way to say that. But you mean they were going to separate and segregate him based on his ability?
Yes.
Is what we're talking about. But that was I chuckled inside when you said that. Okay, this is how I'm hearing this and processing through it as I'm thinking about it is, you're basically saying you've made a choice to see your child with Down syndrome, with an intellectual disability, as a human being, capable of being a human being, right? Like, does that feel like that's the brass tacks? Is that the phrase? I don't even know the phrase. Of what you have, how you've decided to parent on this journey and how you view your son. And I would imagine in how you view people with intellectual disabilities.
Exactly.
And so then I'm wondering, would you say, or is it the case that conservatorship and guardianship are taking that like humanity away from somebody, or is there a place for both of these to play out at the same time? For either of you to answer that.
Yeah. I mean, I could answer what I think Craig and our opinion would be, and then Anna can give some more information on it. I think it's a journey that I'm not saying the guardianship should be abolished. I think there's a place for everything. I think what happens, though, is that we have a tendency to, especially with people with developmental disabilities, put them all in one category and they all have to go that same direction. Rather than sitting back, looking at each individual as an individual making those decisions. Where I am right now, I don't perceive myself needing guardianship from a court. But in another 20 or 30 years, if I'm still living, I don't know where I will be. You know, will I have developed other things that are going to impede my ability to make my own decision? So we need to have choices. I think we need to go with the least restrictive always first, adding in what's necessary for them to succeed. And to me, that's what support decision making is, just as inclusion is in school or inclusion in community. That's taking the least restrictive way of being with a person or having a person be part of life and giving them the tools to do so by supporting them in the area they need the support from. I worry about, and I will be very honest, of ever having any court involvement for anybody. Once you involve an outside government or court entity, you're allowing somebody else to make decisions that don't have any basis to know that person personally. And that scares me. And it does scare me a lot when it comes to Craig, because I want to give him every opportunity to have the life he chooses, not of what he fits into or what's available because of what the state or government has.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear that. Anna, can you touch a little bit on, like, can these work collaboratively, guardianship, conservatorship, and supported decision making?
Yeah.
Or is one better than better? Or, like, I would say that you both would agree one's better than the other, but yeah, that's it. How can they work together? Is there some kind of collaboration there with them?
You know, the analogy that I love is that supported decision making is another tool in the toolbox. Okay. It's, you know, not every person is going to need, you know, guardianship is often presented as a one size fits all. And, you know, the default thing, you've been advocating for your child, you've been fighting for, you know, all the services, all the supports, and now you're 18 and the child is, you know, reaching 18 and now it's time to get the guardianship and get it in place. And if I could quote Sandy, get it now, get it yesterday, get it right away. You know, it's urgent. It's presented that way to a lot of families when it might not be the right fit. And, you know, I would argue that we should kind of flip things on their head and say, instead of guardianship is needed right away, stepping back and really looking at the person and saying, what support would they need to make their own decisions? What might that look like? Bringing in more than just, you know, one person to kind of make an assessment and decide that, but really talking to the members of the community, the family members, the friends, the siblings of that person. And first of all, the person themselves to talk about what they might need to make decisions on their own, because it's going to look totally different for different people. And I think that's what supported decision making accounts for. It's a flexible model where an individual is picking, we call them the decision maker. You know, the decision maker is picking a group of supporters. And I'm sure we can talk about Craig's amazing support team. They're picking supporters who they trust, who can help them express their will and preferences, both making decisions and communicating decisions. And some people like Sandy and Craig have been doing this informally for a long, long time. And other people, you know, have just started to do it now that it really has a formal name. And it really is a flexible model. So I do think practically speaking, you know, I've worked with people who are under guardianship who then try out supported decision making to see if it might work for them. And I think that's absolutely possible. And I want to encourage that, encourage people to, with fidelity to the principle of supported decision making, you know, find a way to try out making their own decisions with a supportive guardian, because a lot of guardians are really interested in maximizing the independence of and decision making of the person whose life they're involved in. So I think we need to really open up to that. And I wouldn't rule that out, but obviously you want to do it with fidelity to the principle of supported decision making, which is Craig is the boss. At the end of the day, Craig decides, no one else. You know, he can ask for advice. Look, mm-hmm. I wish everyone could see the video, because Craig has a great expression on his face right now when I said he's the boss, because it's true, Craig, right? You're in control.
Yes. Stop. Are you embarrassed?
No.
Nope.
No, my boy, my human, number one, gotta walk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. He's the boss, so he gets to vote for who he wants, including when he says Donald Trump.
Okay. Now yeah, we know. Yeah. Now we know the mystery. Mystery revealed. I I can see it and understand it. My next question is, and I would say as a parent listening, it makes so much sense. And thankful for an extra tool in the toolbox. I have found in my own journey in the disability space as an advocate and an ally and raising two children with Down syndrome, that just because I have a kid with a disability doesn't mean all of the ableism in my life has been undone. And I think a lot of parents raising children with intellectual disabilities never really face that. And so then you get to a point where like you just do these things and continue to see your child. This sounds so harsh, but I think this is a reality and people can come at me. But you continue to see your child as less human because of their disability if you don't do that work in yourself of undoing ableism, which is foundational to all of our upbringings in this world, right? In our society. I'm just getting too deep here. But so then it makes sense to me, parents, you just go down the steps, right? Like how, you can't know what you don't know. And so when someone says, this is what you do when your child has an intellectual disability, this is what you need to do. You need to be in charge of them because they are unable to do A, B, C, or D. Naturally, that's what you'll do. Because there's not another option. So like you said, that supported decision-making is a tool in your toolbox, another tool in a toolbox. It just creates that option and creates freedom and creates an opportunity to question what you've believed and been told always about something or a situation. And you may still go the direction, right? I'm sure people who are very familiar with supported decision-making might still go the direction of guardianship or conservatorship. And I would imagine too, like maybe Craig as the boss may come to a point where he's like, Mom, I would like for someone else to take over and for there to be a guardian maybe at some point. Right? Would that be part of the supported decision making? Is that person gets to then say, at some point, this may need to happen. I mean, you were saying that for yourself, Sandy, like at some point in my life, we may need this court order. Or do you not ever need it?
I think it's both.
Okay.
You know, we've done a lot of work. I think Craig and Anna and myself really starting to really get to know other interested groups of people that have been looked at as being ones that need to have guardianship. People with intellectual disabilities, the elderly is a big, big population. And again, the assumption is when you get to a particular age or what the society thinks as a mental ability, if you start starting to forget where to put your keys or where, you know, who that person might be by name, is it that we then have to look to government to have guardianship and have somebody appointed? I'm not sure. You know, I don't know what the future will hold. I do ask parents when they, because I also work in the field. I've been working for a nonprofit human service agency for over 30 years and have worked very hard of being connected with various groups, in particular Massachusetts, our Developmental Disability Council, our other different family groups, is what is it do we think that guardianship's going to do? And I ask that of many families, like when they approach me, because I've helped families, you know, learn how to obtain a guardianship. And the first thing a family will say is that they're afraid their loved one's going to be victimized. And then I'll go in to say, well, what areas do you think they're going to be victimized at? Many say financially. And I say, well, you know, and I'm not saying it's wrong or right to think that way. But I know when a person turns 18, as like Craig, he did then start receiving SSI because he is low income. He does have a developmental disability, Down syndrome, that's looked at it with the Social Security Administration as one of the areas where a person would qualify. And one of the first things that you do with that process, who will be your rep payee that will help you with your financial stability and what you use your funding for, your money for? And so there are things already in place to help safeguard those, where I'm not saying anything is perfect. If I were Craig's guardian at 18, that doesn't mean that there wouldn't ever be a possibility of being a victim in some parts of his life, including financially. And I say that because we did experience that when he was younger. He it again, it was through a, you know, a younger sister's friend at that particular time, victimized Craig in a situation where he took his debit card, he went to the bank and took all of his money. It didn't matter whether I was guardian or not. That would have happened. What did we do? We did what I think I would have done with anyone. I didn't look at Craig as, oh my God, he has Down syndrome. Somebody stole his money. I said, oh my God, somebody stole your money. Let's go down to the police station and make a report. And that's what we did. Even though I was not his guardian, we were able to still pursue the regular legal things anyone would do if they were victimized. The only difference was I didn't drop Craig off at the door of the police station. I went in with him and also his sister. And we explained the situation, gave them the information. Things were rectified. The person was charged. Craig's money was put back into his account. And life went on. So that's why I say I don't think guardianship would have changed anything. That still would have happened. And there are some things in place, such as a rep payee. We do have a healthcare proxy. Craig has a healthcare proxy. He has a power of attorney ready. But so do I for my loved ones, that if I could never make my own decision. So we do have safeguards. So it's not as if I'm saying, here, you're 18, you're on your own. Good luck. Have a nice life. Call me when you're done. You know, we're walking that journey, and it's just a journey where I don't want to put more limitation on them than's already perceived by society. You know, especially with the Down syndrome, it's an obvious disability. People see it right away, and there's an assumption a lot of times that they can't make decisions. And as moms, especially moms that have children with Down syndrome, we know there's so much more that's within them that they have the ability to learn, to understand, and make very good, sound decisions.
Yeah. Anna, can you talk us through what some of the central issues are on overuse of a guardianship system?
Sure. I mean, I think it starts in schools. A lot of school IEP teams or people working in special ed just sort of are kind of by default recommending guardianship, you know, to families as they're working on transition. I think that's the number one way that the research has shown, and anecdotally we see that there's kind of a flow. We call it the school to guardianship pipeline, where schools are really giving parents that advice. And then I think there's a wide variety of providers who are doing the assessments for the guardianship, and that's going to look different in every state what kind of medical professional is doing that. But a lot of, there's a lot of variation. Just anecdotally, sometimes I hear, even in one county in Massachusetts, it's much easier to get a guardianship than in others, in part because they're sort of providers who figure, well, if you're coming to me and you have this diagnosis, you definitely need a guardianship, and kind of just approving that. And then others who are taking a much more serious look at the person and really assessing whether they need that level of intervention, if that's really the least restrictive alternative, or if someone could benefit from supported decision making instead. And so that's another kind of place where there could be education and opportunity to educate. And same with the courts. You know, there's a variation. There are court decisions in so many states now, I can't list them all, where courts have looked at a guardianship case and said, this person is either using supported decision making and doesn't need a guardianship, or has basically an informal supported decision making arrangement. Because that's an important piece. It can be formal and written up in a written agreement, or it can be more informal. And that's important culturally, too, for, you know, different populations are more interested in having it written up, and other folks, for their culture, it's more reflective of actually the way decision making happens anyway across generations in their communities, particularly in some immigrant communities. So for all of those all that is to say, you know, that in courts, you're going to see sometimes that will be the point of intervention. And so I think it's all of those things kind of lumped together that result in the overuse of the guardianship system. And, you know, I'm sure we'll get into this some more, but there are only, you know, there are a lot of states that have supported decision-making laws passed, but many that don't. And I think, you know, when you don't have a law in place, people just might not know. And that's a big part of it. So in states where they're, you know, supported decision-making isn't on the books, so to speak, that can result in a reliance on the guardianship system. And just frankly speaking, it's familiar to people. Guardianship and conservatorship are familiar. This actually should be really familiar to people. As soon as we start talking about it, you know, Heather, you're nodding your head, like this just makes mm-hmm. sense. It's just how people make decisions, just more formalized and more with more a higher level of support and a more personalized level of support. But it's very logical. It really makes sense. And so it should be, I think once people learn about it, it really is something a lot of people will maybe try out before guardianship or try out before 18 in some kind of way. But until we get it so that people really know exactly what's in that toolbox that they could access, then we're going to still see this overuse of the guardianship system just because it is it's had a pretty long head start, so to speak, but we're making headway.
So what is the process? You had said that for some people it is less formal, depending culturally where they're at, but I'm imagining, and I've always assumed for guardianship and conservatorship, there is a process, there are steps that you're taking and it's formal. What is it for supported decision-making? And at what point, sorry, this just brings up so many more questions for me. So my daughter Mason turns 18 in 3 years, bless. At what point do I do something? Like, do you have to do something when your kid turns 18? Or I'm throwing all that out there. What is the process here if I'm saying we are choosing supported decision making mm-hmm. in California? What do I do?
Well, the good news is in California, you do have a brand new supported decision making law. So for everyone listening in California, you can get in touch with the Developmental Disabilities Council. They actually, part of the law included funding for training and some technical assistance that the Developmental Disabilities Council is doing. So hello to all my friends there. And also Disability Rights California was involved in passing the law. I used to work there, so I have to shout them out. They're all fantastic. And so I think the good news is your timing couldn't be better in terms of your daughter turning 18, because for the huge number of folks in California, there will be like this big change in the books. But to speak broadly, you know, about in any state, whether you have a supported decision-making law on the books or not, you know, the first step is really to talk to the person, to make sure the young person about to turn 18 understands, you know, there's this way of making decisions. It's this kind of formalized way of providing support, and make sure they really understand what it is so that they know, is this something they want to do? Is this something that they're going to, the buy-in has to be on both sides. Both the supporters have to think this will work for them and the decision maker, you know, because otherwise if any piece is missing, then it doesn't work. So, you know, people can then choose to just sort of identify their supporters. One thing we really recommend people think about is what kind of support they're going to want, what kind of support they need. You know, there might be someone, there's plenty of people that I've met who just really need support around a few areas of their life, maybe healthcare and financial decisions. And everything else they kind of got covered, like they're really not going to need a lot of support. And other people are going to have a much longer list. And then it's all about, it's so highly individualized. So it's really all about figuring out who you want support from, what that looks like, how much, and just having kind of a long conversation over not just one, you know, cup of coffee, but over a period of time so that everyone really understands, you know, what this looks like. And a lot of times it's going to be a pre-existing relationship. You know, I am so privileged. I am someone's supporter, and they asked me to be their supporter after we had worked together for a long time. And I advised this young man about his professional life and his work, and along with a number of other people. And I'd already been doing it for a while. So when he asked me to be a supporter, it was the most natural thing. And I was honored and thrilled. And it is like beyond a privilege to be his supporter. And so I think that that's the ideal scenario where it's not, you're not kind of pulling in random people. You're relying on the natural community and just sort of giving everyone this title. And then you can write that up in a written agreement. There's lots of examples. If you're in a state with a supported decision-making law on the books, you're going to have to, you know, follow some more. You want to make sure you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's. But they're all designed to be accessible. You know, the purpose is to make it. It's not like, you know, setting up a will or something's extremely complicated. They're meant to be designed so that, you know, it's accessible. You know, the state legislatures may tinker with them a little bit, so it might look a little less accessible. But, you know, if you choose to do it in a more formalized way, then you work to kind of all that work you've done to decide what kind of support network you want, then you're reflecting that in your written agreement. And then thinking about the other things that Sandy and Craig mentioned, like the healthcare proxy or power of attorney or additional supports like a rep payee or, you know, other kind of things you might want to think about. And obviously if someone has what assets they have are going to control how much of a time, how involved that is going to be, then, you know, if there's a special needs trust or something, there would be extra steps you want to take just to make sure you really understand all the implications. And there's, you know, of course, you'd probably be working with a lawyer anyway for those things. So that would be an important part of it.
Okay. And when am I doing this? At what age are we, does it make sense? Do you wait till they're 18, or at what age do you start this process?
You know, one of the things that Craig and I began doing, and I think it was also a matter of necessity at the time, when he was sick, when he was turned 13, he ended up having strep throat. He aspirated on the strep and he got bacterial pneumonia. He was airlifted to another hospital, where when they came to pick him up, they intubated him and injured his trachea. And it ended up with, you know, 6 years of, you know, having a lot of time in the hospital, a lot of extra care, a lot of uncertainty of his future. And it began right there that I knew that he needed to be heard. It was him that was going through it medically. It wasn't me. And the very first time he went into the operating room, and he went in every 8 weeks for 6 years. They would go in and into the OR at Mass General Hospital in Boston. Was they had his arms tied down when he came out of the operating room. And the first thing I did is I looked at the people that were pushing the gurney. I said, "Why do you have his arms tied down?" They said, "We didn't know what he would do when he woke up." And I said, "Well, did anybody think to maybe tell him what you did to him so when he wakes up, he knows what to expect?" And that's all Craig needs. And that's all he still needs. You know, again, is that assumption of more of in a negative way rather than even if I were in that position, I would hope that my loved ones around with me would be telling me, you know, this is what's happening. This is what's going on. Craig could tell you anything there is about a tracheostomy and the G-tube because he experienced it more so than I can. It's giving him the right to be able to say, "This is happening to me. I'm the one that's more experienced than anyone else, and I should be able the one to be given the information." You know, you're not going to give him, even with me, you're not going to give me certain technical terms that I'm not familiar with, but I can definitely tell you, this is what's happening. This is how it's going to, you know, you're going to wake up. There's going to be a tube in your throat. This is how you're going to breathe. He knew that. Anybody came near him. Mm-hmm. And there was a, when he first had his first surgery, they actually stitched his chin to his chest so he could not lift his head up. And the objective for that was to allow the trachea to heal. And there was a well-intended hospital worker that walked by him one day and tried to lift his chin up. He said, "Why don't you look up at me?" is what he said. And his intent was not to hurt him, But there's that assumption again. And his trachea fell apart that 2 days later. I don't know if it was a result of that man stretching it out or what it was. And he ended up back in the OR and turning blue and not being able to breathe. You know, so it's like those journeys are so important to know that he has to have that journey. He has to have the ability to have that information, the knowledge. And so that our journey has always been, it's his life. He's experiencing it. He, out of anybody, has to tell you whether it's a good experience, a bad experience, or if he needs help with it. And some days he needs more help in situations than others. And he has, you know, I like the way that Craig's is put in place. He does have a support decision making on paper. He shares it with all of his key people in his life, the hospital, the healthcare systems. Actually, I don't think he shared it with our state Department of Developmental Services because he doesn't really have a huge connection. He has a service coordinator. He only sees once or twice a year. He'd rather share it with the people that he really knows and is close to. And I love that he chooses who those people are. Doesn't mean that he can only talk to them about certain things, but those are the ones he really looks toward to help him in parts of his life. Actually, we're in his home now, and downstairs is a paid staff member that Chris. You like Chris?
Yeah.
Is he your favorite?
Yeah, my brother.
Your brother. He's a brother from another mother, we say. And Chris is Craig's same age. Actually, I think he's 1 or 2 years younger. And it's important to him to be able to talk to Chris and not mom or dad or my sister. He wants to hang with Chris, get to know what Chris is. He likes everything that Chris does. They have the same interests in wrestling, which I can't take. music, you name it. And, you know, the dating relationships. He's not going to come to me and talk to me about it, nor do I want him to. I want him to talk to other guys his age. And Chris naturally stepped into that role and is a magnificent support person that has opened so many doors for Craig to just be Craig and a guy in his 30s, like living the best life, I guess. And that's what we all want for our kids.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and yeah, I just am, I'm so happy that he gets to do that. The best stories are the stories I hear about later on than the ones that that people come and ask me first. Because you have that tendency. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter whether people think I'm a guardian or don't think I'm a guardian. There's that assumption that many families will have when you have a child with a disability like Down syndrome that it used to be, oh, we're thinking about going to a wrestling event in 2 weeks. What do you think? Now they don't even ask me. I hear about it 2 or 3 weeks later. Oh, yeah, we went to wrestling. Didn't you hear? I have no clue. I love those stories because that's life. You know, I don't know what my daughters do every day, nor should I. And I don't tell my parents what I do every day. I still don't want them to know everything. And they're in their 80s.
It's that humanity in us, right? Like seeing that in our loved ones with intellectual disabilities and supporting them as full humans. Thank you for sharing all that, Sandy and Craig. I have one more question. I told you guys we were only going to go 30 minutes, but this is so informative and interesting and so important. A lot of our listeners, and this kind of goes back to me saying like, when do I start? But a lot of our listeners do have younger kids. We're pretty sure that the majority of our listeners are parenting younger kids with Down syndrome. We'll say 10 and under. And as you think about that person, what do you say to them? They're listening to this and maybe they're like a go-getter and they're thinking, oh my gosh, I need to what? Like fill in the blank there. What do you say to that parent?
Well, I would say the most important thing they can do is talk to other parents and adults with Down syndrome or adults with disabilities who are using supported decision making or hear or learn their stories. Because that's, to me, the most powerful connections that I've seen made just from talk. And there are so many people who are willing to talk about their experience. And I think getting to hear from a peer who understands, what it's really like, I think is really valuable, because I think it can be scary. We don't want to diminish that, it's intimidating to deal with these, institutions that you have to deal with, like whether it's a medical institution, Social Security, all these different things. And when you're doing things a little bit differently, hopefully it will increasingly be less unusual and more mainstream to use supported decision making. That's our goal. But when you're doing things outside the norm and outside what's expected, I think it's really valuable to hear from others about, this is what it's really like. Here are the upsides, here are the downsides, here's why, and I think most people would say, here's why it's worth it at the end of the day for us. Mm-hmm. And also just to see the possibility, because I think one thing we haven't touched on a ton that I hear over and over is how much, supported decision-making can allow people to grow in their independence. And it's so extremely logical, but when you get to practice making decisions, you get better at making decisions. And my anecdotally, personally, what I've seen in terms of, the growth and the independence that people have experienced, whether it's people who were previously under guardianship and are now using supported decision making, or people who've never been under guardianship and always just practice supported decision making, you really see that it makes a real difference in people's lives to be able to know that they're the boss, to know that they're the decision maker, mm-hmm. and to know that there's, an opportunity to, just like anyone else, make good decisions and bad decisions and learn from them. Because we apply this different standard to disabled people than we do to everyone else in the universe, that they're somehow not allowed to make bad decisions when, I'm sure every person can list off just the bad decisions they've made this month pretty quickly. But, it's that, so I think it's never too early to start. I think choice is something that all parents are always thinking about, but there's, an extra important conversation about giving your young child a lot of choice and a lot of autonomy, as appropriate for their age, and really seeing that as practice for potentially using something like supported decision making if it's the right fit for that family and that person. But I'm sure Sandy has even wiser things to say. She always does. And Craig, I'd love to hear if you have any advice for young people too. I bet you have something interesting.
I would say one of the key things I think for Craig was we always, the try, why not attitude. When he was 14, that was it. At 14, I told him, you're going to every single IEP meeting you ever have the rest of your school life. Because again, it's not about me making those decisions. Even at 14, I wanted to make sure that the schools, the teachers, the administration knew he needs to be part of the conversation. Because the worst thing I could ever imagine is being told, you weren't included in the conversation, but guess what? You're doing this today.
Right.
And again, we have very often, one time I remember Craig being, I think, in kindergarten, and the special ed teacher at that particular time said he was non-compliant. And I looked at her, I said, that's a good thing. I don't want him to be compliant. What do you get out of life being a compliant person? So we learn from trial and error. And how are you going to do that except going out and living life? I know. If you ask Craig, do you want to go on a roller coaster now? He'd be like, no, I'm good with that. Every time I go and, get a pierced ear, or my daughter had me get a tattoo, which I'm getting older, but I'm getting tattoos now.
Love it.
I ask Craig all the time, do you want to go get a tattoo? And he's like, hell no. But it's offering that opportunity, and I bring him and he sees it. And it's like anything in life. If you don't try something, you don't know whether you're going to like it or not. And so I just tell you, the parents that have younger children, just try. I found out Craig is not going to be great at sports. Guess what? He never did sports. He did. We tried the baseball. We tried the football. We tried, you know, swimming. We tried horseback riding. He's tried all kinds of things. But mm-hmm. shortly afterwards, you could definitely tell by his demeanor, his expressions, and his desires. He's like, nope, don't like that. I'm like, okay. You know, again, yeah. let them be their own individual. I know that, you know, he definitely... I want to honor his personality, the person he is. It is not about the disability at all. It first comes to who that person is and what they want, with the journey they want. They're going to tell you. They're going to show you one way or the other. It's just being mm-hmm. alongside them and giving them the opportunity to expand on whatever that is.
It's so good, Sandy and Craig. I appreciate you sharing that. It made me think about one of my very dear friends who has Down syndrome, and her mom, they were at a library when she was like a teenager, a young adult, and she had seen sewing machines and said something to her mom like, I would love to learn to sew. And her mom thought, I would never in a million years think about that, you know. But her mom, you remind me so much of each other, just like all the opportunities and exposure to all that life has to offer. And then this friend of mine now owns a business. That's her main source of income. She owns a business where she makes incredible products, and she's an incredible seamstress. It's like, you're our like dear parent. And I say this to myself, like, our kid with Down syndrome is capable of doing anything that they desire to do, that they desire to do, you know, not like, hey, there's this campaign telling us kids with Down syndrome can whatever, fill in the blank. That is true too. But maybe that isn't the case for your kid, but your kid has something about them that they desire to do, that we have this opportunity to give them all the exposure to all the things so that they can find that. Just like with all our kids, right? Like with us, as humans, you can't know what you don't know. So giving kids that opportunity to find that is so important. Thank you for sharing that, Sandy.
Thank you. And you know, Craig, I mean, I could say that I'm thankful that I got this wonderful, fun journey to go along with too. You know, he's taken us mm-hmm. on some most interesting rides in life, and I can't wait to see what the next 30 years is going to bring us, because he has opened my life to so many more new things, because I wouldn't have probably done a lot of those things myself. I'm not one to yeah. I would rather be in the back of the room and nobody ever talk to me, and look at, I'm doing a podcast.
And here you are. And you were great. You're great on podcasts. So now there's something to know about yourself. Craig too. Craig is now a podcaster. There you go. I love it. Okay. Where you said that not every state has supported decision-making. A listener right now, we're going to end our episode. And where can they go to find more? Or is it, do they email you? Like, where our listeners go right now?
I would say the first, a great stop to shout out is the Center for Public Representation has a wonderful website. You'll get to see Sandy and Craig's face on there, all about supported decision making. It's called supporteddecisions.org. And that has so many links to so many other resources too. So that's a great first place, supporteddecisions.org. And it has kind of everything from a getting started guide to supported decision making, to a list of resources, to some stories. So I would say that's a great place to start. And in no matter what state you're in, it's likely that your state's protection and advocacy agency, which is often Disability Rights California, Disability Rights Oregon, you know, whatever the state, typically that's what it's called, they're likely working on supported decision making. So that's a great first stop too in your state. And those can all be found if you go to ndrn.org, that's National Disability Rights Network. They have a list of all the different protection and advocacy agencies in every state.
That's great. Very helpful. Listener, we'll have links to all of those on our show notes, so easily clickable for you. Anna, Sandy, Craig, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with us, and listeners, for answering my questions. I still have a lot more, but we'll have to have a follow-up conversation. I'm gonna bring you back into my world selfishly as I'm on this journey. But thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your stories and expertise. It means a lot.
Thank you very much.
Such a pleasure. Craig, do you want the last word? Are you going to get the last word in?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Craig.
Awesome.
We're going to take a break and be right back. All right, this conversation left me with so much to think about. I'm grateful for it. I'm going to be revisiting it. And I'm excited to hear from you listeners on our Instagram page, The Lucky Few Pod, your experiences and your thoughts on this. If you're familiar with or have used supported decision-making, would love to hear back from you as well. Or if you have any other additional resources on the topic, head over to The Lucky Few Pod on Instagram. You can share those there. All right, we're going to wrap this episode up. Friends, you can also right now, for podcast listeners only, that's you, you guys get a special discount code to the Lucky Few shop that other people don't get. So you can go to theluckyfew.co, that's theluckyfew.co, use code podcast and get 10% off all of your narrative shifting gear. Make sure that when you wear that gear, you tag us, The Lucky Few Podcast or The Lucky Few Official. Thank you, Josh Davis, for editing this episode, Ashley Fracolosi for producing it. And if you liked this episode, listener, share it with family and friends. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. Check out theluckyfewpodcast.com for show notes and the links to the things we talked about in this show. We will have important links there that I'm sure you're going to want to get. And then make sure that you are following on social media at theluckyfewpod. And listener, we want you to know, you are slaying it, and we love you. We're always here cheering you on. Can't wait to be together for another amazing episode next week. Until then, see ya.